I recently read that, I think it was June 12th, that a group was reintroducing to bring forth a new assault weapon ban for the United States, and wondering how that is going to fare now.
I'll take a stab at it. Don might have a comment as well. The ideal way to challenge a gun law would be a situation where all firearms are banned from a home. Back in the 1990s, the ATF directors wrote a letter to somebody in Texas saying that if you homeschool, you cannot have a gun in your home because it's a school zone and you're subject to the Gun-Free School Zones Act. And that would have been the ideal challenge to bring a Second Amendment case, but the Justice Department wouldn't defend that view, and so it never became a case. Those of us who've done strategy thought that the D.C. ban would be a good one to challenge because all handguns are banned, and that strategy ultimately did work. The thing about assault weapons is that in some ways they're the most constitutionally protective of all arms, if you're talking about semi-automatic rifles, because they're a mirror image of military weapons, although they're not fully automatic. But the press and the media and the politicians have done a wonderful job in denigrating these kinds of firearms with use of that term. And remember back the rhetoric before the federal assault weapon ban passed, they're the favorite tool of drug dealers and child molesters and terrorists, and favorite tool of, people who do shoplifting and, you know, everything bad you could think of. So it's been difficult to challenge those laws. We've challenged them in certain states. California, you don't have a right to bear arms guarantee, but in Ohio and Connecticut and some other places, and the courts upheld those. Colorado, even. I hope the time comes again when they can be challenged successfully. We know what the Heller decision holds. We don't know to what extent it would be held to apply to so-called assault weapons. But I look forward to the day when we have more case law developed that's favorable in the Second Amendment, and maybe these laws go by the wayside at some point.
Do you have an opinion about the prospects that the 5-4 decision will be reversed at some future point, and the decision may go the other direction at some point in the future?
I don't think it'll be reversed. You may have a composition of the court could be changed radically where it would be watered down, and you would have an opinion like, you know, this doesn't resolve the standard of review, for example. Is it strict scrutiny? Is it rational basis? Well, that was rejected, but it might be some intermediate standard. And what these courts did that upheld the so-called assault weapon bans were to say, oh, what a fundamental right the right to keep and bear arms is, but these are special weapons, and you can have all these other weapons to defend yourself, and so you don't need them, and they're especially dangerous and all. So if the court changes for the worse, then, yeah, you could have a watering down. It would be very, very rare to have just a blanket reversal of that opinion.
I disagree with that only in this respect. Let me actually, as a prelude, say that I'm not a Republican or a Libertarian. I'm a liberal Democrat. And I tell you, if you elect Barack Obama, the Heller decision will be reversed within his presidential terms.
What are the implications of Heller for bearing arms as opposed to just keeping arms in the home?
Well, one advantage of the opinion was that it does speak to that issue, and it makes clear that bearing means carrying. That was part of the refuting the so-called collective rights view, because that view was that bearing arms only meant in the military. And so, of course, it's all dictum, but on the other hand, I think it's going to help out in the following respect. It'd be difficult to frontally assault any state licensing requirement. I mean, the court itself sanctions licensing for carrying, and also banning concealed weapons, which was the 19th century way of regulating guns. But I think it'll help make procedures more fair if you can say that if it's a right that's enshrined in the Constitution, then when you have procedures to obtain concealed weapon permits, let's say, that I think you'll start seeing more procedural due process, because you can say that if it's an interpretation of the law or maybe an abuse of discretion, then I think there's less room for arbitrary and capricious decisions.
I volunteer in this a community center where two of the largest political clubs in San Francisco have their meetings, and I've heard them talk about wanting to ban firearms as to get rid of a voting block. And so, how that Don or either you, how valid do you think that is? Do you think that's a very common reason to try to? I mean, they might use the excuse to regulate crime. I don't know. So those are my two questions.
As to the second, banning guns, this is a culture war issue. These people on the other side wish to impose their views of morality on those of us who are immoral enough to want to be able to defend ourselves. And it's an interesting question whether, if the Heller decision does stand, those people may just stop bothering with gun control, because their point is to get rid of guns. And if they can't get rid of the guns, they might just decide to fold their tents and go away. But on the other hand, passing more and more controls that make it more and more difficult for gun owners is something these people like. It satisfies their cultural desire to impose their views.
The lady right there.
How would that apply to California trying to ban the lead bullet?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
How would that apply to California's attempt to ban bullets?
Can't be done. I mean, I'm a lawyer. I should remember that. Any shit that can be produced by man, lawyers and legislators are stupid enough to pass. That being, and judges are stupid enough to uphold. That being said, still, there is a relevant Supreme Court analysis. There was a case in which the state of Pennsylvania had made it extremely difficult to purchase condoms. You had to do it through a drugstore. You couldn't just do it in an ordinary store, and they had all kinds of rigmarole. And this was defended on the ground that, well, it's not making condoms illegal. It's not doing anything except making it difficult, maybe. And the Supreme Court had no difficulty striking that down as a violation of the fundamental right of people to control their lives and control procreation.
Yeah, in conjunction with a previous question on the right to bear arms, there are two bills, one in the Senate, one in Congress, to enforce 50 state reciprocity for carry permits. either of you have an opinion on the likelihood that that's got a snowball's chance in hell of getting passed?
Well, I don't think it's going to pass anytime soon, frankly, although I think it could certainly be justified constitutionally on the basis of the 14th Amendment incorporating the Second Amendment. But those of us who live in, like, the states where people are for real or laws are, you know, reasonable, the reciprocity exists between the majority of states now, I believe. You can get a, I guess, what is the best permit to get? Utah? I mean, you can get a Florida permit. You don't have to be in state, and you can carry in most other states. Most states now have shall issue, and they have reciprocity with other states. I think
California.
Right, but
it
but you could
have
get
shall issue.
You could no, right, because it's discretionary, and you can deny it to people who don't contribute to your campaign. So, but you could get a Florida license and carry in other most other states. You do have that option, or you could leave California.
Which I did.
So, other than Cruikshanks and Presser, what are the best arguments against incorporation for the other side?
The arguments against incorporation?
What are the best ones they can make?
There are none. Good. There's nothing. I mean, there used to be an argument about incorporation that said the Second Amendment is a right of the states, not a right of individuals. So it can't be incorporated. As far as I know, no one has ever made any other argument. Heller demolishes that argument, and they haven't come up with one yet. Maybe they will come up with something, but I don't think so.
Can I just add to that? Cruikshank only held that private action could not deprive people of the rights to assemble and to keep and bear arms. Presser only held that you can be required to get a license for an armed march by a military group in a city. And that it also said the First and Second Amendments don't apply directly to the states. And we argued this in the Fresno Rifle and Pistol Club in the Ninth Circuit, and we pointed out that the third case in the latter part of the 19th century, Miller versus Texas, the court explicitly said the Second and Fourth Amendments don't apply directly, and as to your argument that they apply through the 14th Amendment, you didn't make it in the court below, so we're not going to consider it. So the Supreme Court has never, ever ruled on the issue, and the Ninth Circuit said, well, it did in Presser, and it ignored Miller versus Texas. For those of you who aren't, you know, into this, sorry, but the Supreme Court's never ruled on the issue, and now it's made clear in Heller that it's reaffirmed that it never ruled on the issue.
How about here, and then we'll go to the back.
So I was wondering if I could get some thoughts from you, if you have any, about what the future of anti-scholarship may be now in the post-Heller era.
Well, the anti-scholarship, they're very depressed and they're in disarray. They've been very smug all these years, and like I said before, they think they depicted us as crackpots, and they could, without laughing, say that the right of the people to keep and bear arms doesn't mean the right of the people to keep and bear arms. I think you're going to see a lot of money still coming in from Joyce Foundation and groups like that. The same likely suspects will be doing, generating so-called scholarship about, well, okay, it doesn't increase the murder rate, but increases the suicide rate. And as far as rebelling against the Supreme Court decision, that started already. D.C. says they're not going to register handguns. If they're semi-automatic, they're only going to register revolvers. So this fight has just begun. It's not over.
There's a in the back.
This question is to both of the presenters. We have not talked about economic infringement, such as license fees, registration fees, and class discrimination. I'd like your opinion on economic discrimination, where you have onerous licensing fees or registration fees and a class discrimination against the poor.
I have written in an early article, an article whose conclusions Steve branded Orwellian Newspeak. I said that registration and licensing were perfectly constitutional, assuming that permits were issued and registration was allowed to all law-abiding responsible adults. Now, the issue of speed and the issue of money are important issues. So let me add that New York State can have all the registration and permit laws it wants, as long as those laws provide that if a woman comes in because her ex-husband is threatened to kill her or because she's being stalked, if she comes in on Monday, New York can make her hide someplace until Wednesday and then issue her a permit, having gone through all the checks they want. And if that doesn't work for them, then they can put up more money, billions of dollars if necessary, to produce a 24 or 48 hour check. That's what I mean by registration and permits. Those are the registration and permits which I consider to be legal, not something that any of the Andes would be willing to accept.
If there's procedural due process requiring a permit to actually carry a handgun, let's say concealed or whatever, I think that's so well settled now that that's not going to be questioned, and Heller makes that clear, and it's clear under the laws of most of the states. And also the federal instant check, in which there's a 24-hour limit on the amount of time they can keep your identity and the records have to be destroyed. I don't think you'll ever see a successful Second Amendment challenge to something like that. But if it's just a pure registration requirement that you have to register to exercise a constitutional right, then I think there's potential problems with that. And my next book, by the way, is on how the Weimar Republic passed registration, and when the Nazis came to power, they used the list to disarm all enemies of the state and Jews. And so it's certainly bad policy. And whether there'll be a decision on that, I mean, most states, and certainly not the federal government, do not require registration other than for NFA firearms, for example. It's not that generally done in the law in most of our society. I don't know whether you'll ever see a successful challenge to that, but I still think as a constitutional matter to require somebody merely to possess a gun, to require them to register, I just don't see the difference in requiring Jehovah Witnesses to register or people to register who are of some faith or political belief.
Don, don't you think that Steve was insightful in saying that he thought that fees would be twisted, as you're saying they have been?
Yes.
Right. Of course. Okay. How about right over here?
Does this Heller case now invalidate the Ninth Circuit standing problems we've had in California?
Yes.
So are Americans now going to be able to get standing to defend their Second Amendment right?
Well, we've got to go through this 14th Amendment incorporation business, too. I'm sure if Reinhart gets your case, it's the challenge that's out here now in the public housing in San Francisco, I'm sure he'd like to invoke that same doctrine, but it'll be totally transformed. And I have to say, even in the Silva era opinion, Heller said that if it was an individual right, it would be incorporated like other Bill of Rights guarantees, because and he actually called the Presser decision outdated.
In the corner there?
Yeah. One of my best friends is a police officer, but the truth be told, I'm very excited by this decision, because I'm hopeful that if more people can bear arms, the police are going to be more reluctant to continue their genocide of people of color and the poor. Can you, either of you or both of you, speak to the more expansive our Second Amendment rights are, the less likely that police are to break down doors without warrants, to kill people on the streets, etc.?
Up to you.
I think a lot of your average cop on the beat, many of them are gun owners, and they sympathize with you. And in D.C., they'll tell you to get a gun even if it's illegal, if you've been burglarized. There are police officers who misuse their authority. Traditionally, police in a repressive society, including our own, have been used as instruments of, like, white supremacy or otherwise. And certainly in totalitarian societies, they are instruments of genocide. So recognition of this right is a right against tyranny and a right involving independence and self-reliance of the individuals.
The traditional idea was the gun is the great equalizer with those who are the weakest. How about that right there?
If the licensing fee is exorbitant and people can't afford it, does that meet Heller?
Can you repeat that? Yeah.
If the licensing fee is exorbitant, does that meet the requirements of Heller?
That goes to your point.
Well, it would, because if you have, let's say, you can restrict First Amendment assembly rights to, for example, in public places requiring permits, and I think the courts would allow for some small processing fee. But if it was a fee that was large and it was obviously intended to dissuade exercise of the right, I think a court would invalidate it, and I think that would be the case here.
What do you see the impact of Heller being on the attempt to ban ammunition in California?
Well, my understanding is, no, actually, I don't want to answer that because I'm not familiar enough with the legislation. As a general proposition, people are entitled to have ammunition for guns. That's part of the Second Amendment right, and anything that a state does to make that impossible or very difficult to exercise should be held invalid.
But I don't think if they, in California, because of the Condor thing, you know, you can't use lead ammunition in certain areas. I don't think that would ever be invalidated under the Second Amendment to use it for hunting, but to have it or possess it, or to use it at shooting ranges which meet EPA standards, I think that might have Second Amendment implications.
Thank you. First off, thank you both for your hard work on this case. It's phenomenal. I am worried about one thing, though, is that I'd like to know what your guess is as to the level, assuming the this is going to be incorporated under the 14th Amendment, what the level of scrutiny required will be from your reading of the decision, because I see that as sort of the valve through which this whole our rights to the Second Amendment can be diluted, whether it'll be a rational basis or intermediate scrutiny or something worse.
Well, it won't be rational basis. That's for non-constitutional rights. That's for activities that are not protected at all in the Constitution. I think it'll be considered a fundamental right. There's Supreme Court precedent saying that if it's a constitutional right, it's a fundamental right. That particularly applies to substantive guarantees in the Bill of Rights. Speech, assembly, arms bearing doesn't necessarily apply to the Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial if it's over $10 in controversy, passed in 1791. But and if that's the case, it'll be strict scrutiny and it'll be compelling state interest. All the tests that we're familiar with from First Amendment law. Could the court do something less than that, intermediate scrutiny? The court can fashion any test it wants. But one thing that's neat about this case, in the oral argument, Chief Justice Roberts said, you know, we're courts make up these standard of review tests. Why don't we just ask, does this law infringe on the Second Amendment? And that's what the court ended up doing.
Yeah, you're right there.
Hi, I've got a question on the state's rights. And it seems as to me that when I travel from state to state, my First Amendment rights and search and seizure protections and so on don't change that much. But from state to state, it's this incredible patchwork of different rights, and I'm a criminal in one state, and I'm perfectly fine in the next. At what point would the Supreme Court step in and say this patchwork is intolerable and cause some kind of a federal uniformity so it's more of a seamless transition from state to state?
I think in the real long run, if we build up a jurisprudence of the Second Amendment, a lot of case law, I think that's a very legitimate point. As it stands, many states have state preemption for the same reason. You go from one city to another, one county to another, and it's a patchwork. It's like a zillion different laws within one state. And what the Supreme Court has done on First Amendment law and Fourth Amendment law is to standardize it for the whole country, to create a minimum base. And so I would hope that's where this would head. But we're right at the beginning of this enterprise, and I think this is going to go on for many, many decades before you reach a point like you're talking about.
Okay.
What did Heller do to Miller?
You might want to explain what that means.
Do you want to address it? You can do it.
Okay. The Miller decision is a decision in 1939 by a very stupid justice and a very careless court in a case in which only the anti-gun side was argued. The challenger was dead by then, and his attorney didn't appear. And the Miller case said, it's hard to summarize because it's hard to understand what it is, but what it basically said was you have the right to possess, or the Second Amendment right applies only to military quality weapons commonly owned among the population. This court has made it much clearer that what the right is to those kind of weapons that are owned in the civilian population. Now, if new weapons are developed, I don't know what the hell that means. But the court over and over again emphasized that handguns are the weapon of choice for very large numbers of Americans, and that's why they are protected by the Second Amendment. Basically, what Heller did as a practical matter is totally eclipse Miller. From now on, decisions are going to be based on Heller, and nobody's going to be citing Miller. Of course, I could be completely wrong. Happens all the time. But that's my ballpark estimate.
Steve, would you say that one of the reasons why what Don is saying is true, and because why the Heller decision is so important, is because this is really the first case on the Second Amendment? Would you say that's fair?
It's the first case where the Supreme Court has taken it serious.
Right.
I mean, there's reasons why we didn't have many previous cases. There was never any federal regulation until 1934, and Miller was the first effort by the court to do that, and it wasn't much of an opinion. But there haven't been any challenges that have reached the high court because there was not a circuit split like developed with Emerson and Silveira, for example, and then Heller in the lower court. So, like I said before, they're just getting started.
How about the gentleman?
What I wanted to ask about was a case that actually has affected us here in the Ninth District. Those of us who suffered under the run of gun control that kept getting stuck down our throats found that when we addressed it with local bodies, and I remember the city of San Jose, we had a meeting with the mayor there, and she looked at us and said, what are you complaining about? You have no individual right. And she was referencing Hickman in 94, where it stood when it was at least applied for cert and didn't go. How does Heller affect what we're stuck with? Because that's basically when, theoretically, in this district, we lost the standing of having an individual right. And since that time, for everything we've done, without a reversal of that, we haven't had any grounds for it. And I know Emerson made us feel better, but is Heller and or the incorporation going to help us get past that? Because that's the basic standing we have now.
Distinguish incorporation. Put that aside for a moment. The Hickman opinion no longer exists. It has been demolished by the Heller opinion. Okay. Now, the Heller opinion has only held the Second Amendment applicable to the federal government. Until incorporation is decided, we don't know what applies to the states. But the Hickman opinion is gone, disappeared like the Avars, a people who disappeared so completely from Europe that for many years their disappearance was considered remarkable. And now no one even knows who the hell they were.
On a long list of politicians I want to send a letter on.
Okay. One more question.
Tell us what arguments we can anticipate from the San Francisco Public Housing Authority.
That the Second Amendment does not apply to the states through the 14th Amendment. I mean, that's the reason this case is brought as a test case. That's going to be their main argument. And the Supreme Court, frankly, is going to have to decide that eventually. You have Ninth Circuit precedent on the Fresno Rifle and Pistol Club case that there's no incorporation. If the Ninth Circuit wanted to do an en banc rehearing on that issue, it would have to do that. But otherwise, we're stuck with that unless the Supremes resolve the issue. That's where all this is going to end up.
If you would all join me in thanking our two speakers. As I said earlier, Steve and Don really are heroes. They have been, they've gone through an enormous amount. They have stuck to the truth, and they've illuminated discussion. At the Institute, we're involved in issue after issue, public policy issue, issues of ethics and metaphysics and law and all sorts of things. And what passes for the zeitgeist is often dismissive in the extreme. But I think this is a good example of an enormous success based on people of integrity and making the case and making it very effectively. I hope everyone will be able to get a copy of Steve's book. It's one that is going to go down in history. These two gentlemen are going to go down in history. There's no question about it. I want to thank you all for joining with us at this very unusual and historic meeting, and we hope you'll join with us in the future. Thank you for joining with us. Good night.